This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you so much for inviting me once again. And you may be wondering why I'm smiling. I'm smiling because a lot of these things said about me are actually not true. And I find it amusing that people feel that way about me. Nothing special, I'm just a student of Islam. Student of Muslim history, and trying my best to raise awareness about the great, magnificent Muslim civilization and its true achievements. Dawah is one of the ways we do that. Dawah is multifaceted. It comes in different forms and different shapes for different people. As they say, different strokes for different folks. We have intellectual domain. We have the masses to deal with. But it has to go on. It can never stop. I've talked about it today on multiple occasions. And I wasn't prepared for this particular interaction, but I will inshallah share some ideas I celebrate at the moment in my own mind. But when I do share these ideas, hopefully we'll find supporters. One of those ideas I discussed today with Dr. Elias and our other friends and brothers who are present is to establish Islamic museums. And one of the reasons why I love this particular library, last time when I came here, actually was the first time, if I'm not mistaken, I was fascinated by this idea. It is a very, very important aspect of the Muslim civilization, the great forever living Muslim civilization. And one of the greatest achievements of the Muslim civilization was bookmaking, book production, book binding, book writing, calligraphy, transcribing manuscripts in their hundreds of thousands. And Muslims pioneered this field in unprecedented ways. What do I mean by that? The amount of books that were produced during the Muslim period of, let's say, 1,000 years is absolutely immense. Despite all the wars, all the catastrophes, all the burnings of libraries around the world, from Spain to Baghdad, let's say, we still have hundreds of thousands of manuscripts in global libraries that survive. And that indicates that Muslims produced an immense number of books. An immense number of books that we still find such a large collection of books around the world. Now, it is said that after the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella took the last stronghold of Muslims in Spain in the year 1492, over 1 million books were burned by the conquerors. The intention was to wipe out any trace of Islam from the Iberian Peninsula. And in that burning, we have no idea what we may have lost, okay? And even after that burning, we had 10,000 manuscripts in one of the Spanish libraries, and there was a fire in the early 20th century, early 1900s, that burnt much of that library, or much of that collection in Spain. I don't remember the exact location of that library. So why am I mentioning these things? To highlight the point that despite all that destruction and burning of books and removal of that legacy still survives and lives on. Very stubborn, very sticky legacy. You see, Islamic civilization was the flower that left its fragrance in the hand that crushed it. And that's the case to this day. Okay, it was a flower that was crushed repeatedly again and again. I mean, before 1492, we had the catastrophe of the Mongol invasions. So in 1258, we have Hulagu or Hulaku, who attacked Baghdad. And as a result, we lost the library of Baghdad. It is said in reports that books were thrown into the river Tigris, and the river became black. The water was black due to the ink that dissolved in that river. And the manuscripts found in that library could be, you know, from the first century all the way up to that very period, 1258. So we lost a huge chunk of our legacy in books in that particular catastrophe, or during that particular episode of our history, the destruction of the. I'm a manuscript collector. I collect Islamic manuscripts, and the reason why I do that is because I believe this is our heritage. It has to be preserved and protected, and if it's not protected, it will be further lost, and our future generations will never forgive us for being negligent towards it. And we are criminally negligent collectively, not individually. Of course, there are exceptions. There are individuals who are very dedicated to this particular cause. In fact, some of them are non-Muslims. I cannot thank enough one person who's Jewish. He's from Iran. His name is Daoud Khalili. Daoud Khalili has one of the best collections of Islamic manuscripts. And we thank him for that, for preserving, collecting all those manuscripts for posterity. And even the British Museum, as bad as colonialism was, we are aware of colonial history, those who do read. One of the great things that came out of colonialism was the British Museum. Okay, many people complain about it, that a lot of the artifacts are stolen, they were robbed from their original countries, and now they are kept in the British Museum. I'm of the opinion that the British Museum, if not the colonial establishments of the time, did us a favor. At least we can go and see these artifacts, well kept, preserved, protected, and if they are kept in the same way, they will be preserved for the future as well. Now, those countries that complain about their artifacts being stolen and lost, if you look at the state of history and historic objects and archaeological sites in those countries today, you will cry tears of blood, because I have seen the state of history keeping in those countries. So they have no right to complain about these things, unless you can prove us wrong or prove me wrong by resurrecting museums where you can actually preserve your history and heritage. So I am for protecting heritage. Whoever does it, I'm with them, because heritage is a collective legacy of humans. In particular, our Islamic heritage is our source of pride, our source of honor. If we lose our history, if it's lost to destruction, to theft, to vandalism, to wars, then we have nothing to look back to. We have nothing to look up to. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Quran in clear words, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم سيروا في الأرض فانظروا كيف كان عاقبة المكذبين. Go in the land and see what happened to those who came before you. There were virtues there that can be repeated, and there were errors and mistakes that are to be avoided. If we do not have what was left behind by those who came before us, then what lessons are to be learnt? So these are my random thoughts I wanted to share with you, that this is one of the reasons I was very, very much fascinated by this project. This is a revival in the making. People may not realize the importance of libraries in this and this. And you know, a book can never be replaced by PDF. Okay, no matter how beautiful that PDF looks to you, and how convenient it may be to you, because it comes in your device and you can easily click and start reading, but that book, that hard copy, will never be replaced. Never. And the British Library understands that more than anyone else. They have over, if I'm not mistaken, 70 million documents in their possession. Yes. It's one of the greatest, one of the biggest libraries in the world. Okay. And they have one of the best collections of ancient manuscripts. Codex Sinaiticus, one of the oldest complete Bibles, is in their possession. It was taken from Egypt in the 19th century by a man called Tischendorf. He stole it, okay, as things were at that time. He took it from the the monastery of Saint Catherine, if I'm not mistaken, in Sinai, the region of Sinai, just at the bottom of Mount Sinai. There's a monastery there, a Christian monastery, and this manuscript was kept there, and now it is found in the British Library, and it's well kept. It is available to scholars and students alike. Then they have other fascinating books. One of the oldest Qurans in the world is there. It is in the Hijazi script, well kept. People can go and see it, and other artifacts. And this is something we ought to do, we have to do for our future generations. This is something we have neglected. We have resurrected mosques upon mosques. Some of them, they look like palaces, right? Chandeliers, beautiful carpets, beautiful calligraphy and designs and all of that. Beautiful. I mean, it's a great tradition to celebrate, no doubt. But let's make two or three less mosques and make museums instead. Make libraries where our youngsters, our future generations can come and take inspiration from what has been left behind by their predecessors. That's very important. A highly neglected obligation and duty, which is again going through a revival here, right here in front of you. Some of these books are absolutely fascinating. They are amazing because I have some of them in my library, my personal library. And I am fond of books, even though I haven't read most of them in my personal library. But I just, the look of them, you know, I believe my children take inspiration from looking at those books, right? And when I die, my grandchildren, when they look at those books, at least thought, you know, gives me some sort of peace that they will think, oh, grandfather read all these books, right? So it's one of those things. Okay, so there is something. When I was a Talibin, when from
1914.
Wow, absolutely amazing. So this is an antiquarian volume which has been handed to me just now. When I was a Talibin, it's a copy published in London in 1914. Now imagine, this is a Shafi book on Shafi jurisprudence by Imam An-Nawawi, rahmatullahi alayh, and it's published in London in 1914. This is an example how others have come forward to protect our legacy for us. And this is why I value even Orientalism, as negative as a tradition it was. They did some great things for us. Even Orientalists in the 19th century, who many of whom lived in Germany and Britain, they did some great work for the Muslims to take benefit from. One of those works is Edward William Lane's Lexicon. I don't know if Dr. Elias possesses that particular collection, that dictionary, Lane's Lexicon. Sorry for putting you on the spot. You do it. You have it. Oh, great. I'm happy. Okay. That's one of the greatest achievements of an Orientalist, to translate Arabic terminology into the English language. I think it's still one of the best dictionaries in the world. It was a product of Orientalism. Edward William Lane was a man who lived in Egypt in the 19th century. If I'm not mistaken, 1830s, 1840s, and he compiled this great dictionary. And there are other works that were produced by Orientalists for our benefit. An amazing outcome of Orientalism was a book defending the spread of Islam, amazingly, right? There was a man called Professor Thomas Arnold who taught in India, who taught Iqbal, the famous poet, okay, the famous philosopher poet of the Indian subcontinent, the poet of the East, as he's often referred to, was a student of Professor Thomas Arnold, who was a philosopher par excellence. And he taught at Aligarh University and taught at the Government College Lahore. And Iqbal studied under him, and Iqbal was inspired by the teachings of Professor Thomas Arnold. Thomas Arnold could see that some British Orientalists are deliberately writing hostile works on Islam. People like Muir, William Muir, who was a British colonial officer in the Indian subcontinent, who was actually present at one of the debates conducted between Sheikh Rahmatullah Kehranawi, who authored the book Izharul Haq later on, And Fander, who was a German missionary working in India, in particular the city of Agra, preaching the gospel, okay, and the religion of Christianity in the streets of Agra, challenging Muslims, Muslim scholars, backed by the colonial establishment of India. So one of the outcomes was this great debate in 1854 in the city of Agra. Very, very important historical event, directly relevant to your the legacy of your hero in South Africa, or from South Africa, Sheikh Ahmed Didat. Now, where's the connection? Sheikh Ahmed Didat, if you know his story, found a copy of Izharul Haq, the book authored, the very book authored by Sheikh Rahmatullah Kiranwi, in a storeroom when he was used as a punching bag by missionaries to practice their arguments on this young man called Didat, right? And he found this book, and this book changed the face of Dawah in the 20th century. This very young man, who later on became the old man, Sheikh Ahmed Didat, kickstarted or revived the dying obligation of Dawah in the 20th century. And what you see around the world on social media, TikTok, YouTube, and Dawah debates and discussions and dialogues are a dream of Sheikh Ahmed Didat and his example. I have no doubt about that. Because most people I have met who are major Dawah figures in the world, they have been directly inspired by Sheikh Ahmed Didat. So such was the doing of that book of Sheikh Rahmatullah Kiranwi, right? So coming back to William Muir basically was present in that very debate. It was a very disturbing experience for the British colonial establishment, as well as those who were of that persuasion. People like William Muir, who was a Christian missionary of a kind as well. He wrote a biography of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam in 4 volumes. He wrote a book on the history of caliphate, Muslim caliphate, starting from the 4 caliphs and going onwards. He wrote a history of the Mamluk dynasty in the 19th century. So he was very deeply involved in Orientalism, writing works on the history of Islam. So there were individuals like that writing negative work, hostile works on Islam. So Professor Thomas Arnold was a very sympathetic philosopher towards Islam. He had sympathy towards Islam. He liked the Muslim legacy, and he was friends with many Muslim scholars like Maulana Shibli Numani, who was a personal friend of his, and so was Iqbal was one of his students. So he decided to write a book, and the book is titled The Preaching of Islam, and it was a classic, published for the first time in 1896, the first edition, and the second edition was published, enlarged, expanded edition was published in 1914, if I'm not mistaken, The Preaching of Islam. It's a must read for every Muslim. Even though it was a product of Orientalism, it is a must read. So Orientalism wasn't all that bad, as negative a tradition it was. It wasn't all that bad. It gave a lot of positive things for us to take benefit from. So why am I mentioning these things, these random thoughts, is because I am just completely inspired by this example, and this needs to be repeated all over the Muslim world. This and museums that display our legacy, that protect our legacy, that educate our youngsters primarily, our youth, our future generations about the great Islamic civilization, the positives and the negatives. So someone like that, who has that kind of appreciation for the Islamic civilization, I love everything to do with the Islamic civilization, whether it's positive or negative, because it's our story. The positive, just like a person who has good things to remember and bad things to remember, but you got to remember those things so that you can take lessons from them. So I collect everything and anything that comes from Islamic civilization, and if I have the ability to get my hands on it in all legal ways, if possible, I will definitely get my hands on it somehow. Okay, so it is, I believe, a forgotten obligation, you know, to protect our heritage and legacy. That's why I would like to congratulate Dr. Elias and his endeavor. I mean, very, very, very important very important. We cannot thank people like you enough. I don't want to praise you to your face, you know, but, you know, I'm truly inspired. This is one of the examples I mention everywhere I go, that South African Muslims have done something amazing. Okay. We may have other examples like this. I'm not aware of them, in particular the Western world. There are institutions, the Ismaili Center in London, they've done some good work in this regard. They've published some amazing, but they focus on Ismailism, right? Mainly their main focus is to revive the history of Ismaili thought, okay? Which is like a fringe element of the Muslim civilization, no doubt, okay? But it is a great endeavor to protect and to preserve our heritage for our future. So coming to your request to talk about Yvonne Ridley and all that, maybe we can do that another time, but I'll quickly mention I had an interaction with our sister Yvonne Ridley. You must listen to her when she attends. She's a dynamic woman. She has amazing experiences to share. She went through a lot. She went through a lot in the last 20 years from the time she was captured by the Taliban, and then when she was in prison and she was told by one of the Taliban commanders to read the Quran. I met her in London soon after that at Regent's Park Mosque, and I asked her this question when she was not a Muslim, that, are you contemplating Islam? And she said, well, I'm reading the Quran because I promised someone that I will read the Quran. And the person she was talking about that was that unknown Taliban commander, who knows who he was, Allah knows, right? She reads the Quran and eventually accepts Islam. And not only that, she becomes a very strong proponent of human rights, for Muslims in particular, because Muslim blood had become fair game, especially when we were facing the onslaught on media immediately after the catastrophe of 9/11. So she was instrumental in defending the rights of many wronged and oppressed Muslims. One of those cases was the case of Afia Siddiqui, very famous, well-known case, and she did a great job in bringing her case to light, and that's one of the reasons why she was found. She was found in Afghanistan, suddenly she appeared, and then she was sentenced to 86 years in the US. Her children were also found eventually. Her son was sent back to the grandmother. I have seen him personally. His name is Ahmed. Her daughter was found separately, speaking American English in strong American accent, right? And then she was left on the street outside her Afia's house in Karachi. And the third child, Suleiman, who was 6 months old at the time of her kidnapping, hasn't been found. So why I mention this is because this is one of her legacies, Yvonne Ridley's legacies. This is something she did for this oppressed woman, and she continues to campaign for her. She's a great woman. And I invite everyone to listen to her, meet with her when she arrives in Shalatara. Definitely worth spending time with. On that note, please do forgive me if I was saying random things without planning a lecture or talk. So I love to talk about these things. I mean, I have a fascination with books, and I'm a keen book collector. Some old, some new, some recent, some not so recent, and also coins were mentioned earlier. So I am very, very, very fascinated by Islamic numismatics, to the extent that people who travel with me and who know me is smiling, because they know how crazy, how mad I am about Islamic coins and preserving them. In fact, I'll quickly mention one of the gems I found. If I'm boring you, please do forgive me, but this is something I love to talk about, right? You know, everyone has different interests. So one of my interests is collecting, preserving Islamic coins, you know, and they vary from place to place, time to time. Beautiful artwork on them. If you find early Islamic coins, you find Kufic Arabic on them, you know, the earliest form of the Arabic language, right? Beautifully inscribed on these coins. And then when you move forward to the Abbasid period, from the Umayyad period, the coins start to change and the Arabic script becomes more stabilized, more elegant in its form. So it's more kind of square and more round and more artistic, right? When you move forward. And by the time you get to the 10th century CE, some of the most beautiful Islamic pieces of Islamic art you will find are on coins. This calligraphy, those die engravers, those money makers, because these were hammer struck coins, silver and gold. Dinars were gold and dirhams were silver. So when you look at some of these coins, the engravings on them, the calligraphy, the ability to carve with such intricacy and such delicate work on these dies made of, often made of bronze, they were used to strike these coins. Coins would be warmed, they would be basically, they would be made hot, and then this piece of gold would be put between two dies and hammered. So you would see the inscription on them. So it's a huge field that is neglected. By the way, people think numismatics is just a joke. People who collect coins are just kids who haven't grown up, right? That's not the case, okay? Some of these coins are worth millions of dollars if we talk in monetary terms, which is what gets the attention of most people nowadays, right? Yeah, not the historic value, but the monetary value, right? You can find coins, Islamic coins, worth millions of pounds, millions, British pounds, right? There is a coin which is very rare from Abdul Malik bin Marwan, the caliph. It's called the Standing Caliph. The Standing Caliph. It was one of the earlier examples or experiments conducted by his moneymakers, that the caliph is shown standing with a sword, right? And there is an inscription around him, La ilaha illallah wahdahu la sharika. Okay, and then on the other side you find the date. So it was a copy, or the inspiration was taken from the Byzantine, the Roman solidus. That's why they experimented. And then came the fully Islamic reformed coinage in the year 77. And I have a gold dinar, I'm privileged to have a gold dinar from the very next year, 78 Hijri, which is one of the earliest Islamic coins in history, nevertheless. So there is a lot we can learn from coins, absolutely amazing amount of history and information. In fact, we have physical evidence on Islamic coins of Islamic prayer. You see, a lot of these critics, we have a tradition of hadith, we call it the hadith science. A lot of Western historians and scholars, they question the veracity of the hadith tradition. So this hadith tradition is not trustworthy. Okay, why? They give their reasons. And our scholars, on the other hand, Islamic traditional scholars, they argue that it is trustworthy. It is not only trustworthy, it is one of the most powerfully preserved historic traditions in human history. Okay, but amazingly, our hadith tradition is directly supported and confirmed by material evidence, such as inscriptions on rocks in the Arabian Peninsula, manuscript evidence from the first century of Islam, and coins. You may be thinking, coins? How? Well, apart from finding Quranic verses on these coins from the first century, we find Islamic rituals depicted on some of these coins. So there is a coin minted in the year 74 Hijri in Iraq by an Umayyad governor called Bishr bin Marwan, who was a brother of the caliph Abdul Malik bin Marwan. On this coin, which is basically made upon a Sassanid model, because Persians were Sassanids. The Sassanid Empire was, of course, dismantled by the Muslim early Islamic invasions, and the coinage was kept pretty much the same. Muslims, early Muslim rulers, governors were very pragmatic about these things. They didn't come in and start, they didn't start to introduce their own economic order. They didn't change the currency. They kept the currency the same. And then initially they started to add Bismillah on the margins of these Sassanid coins to denote that this is an Islamic issue, not a Sassanid one. But later on, other experiments were conducted. One of those was Bishr bin Marwan, 74 Hijri, minted a dirham in Iraq to basically signify the supremacy of the caliph in Damascus, who was Abdul Malik bin Marwan. How was that demonstrated? The caliph is seen to be leading prayer, salah, right, on that coin. And he has attendants or muqtadis, what we call muqtadi, the ones who pray behind the imam. So he had two followers on this coin. You can see them depicted. So the caliph is raising his hand to start the prayer, what we say, Rafal Yadain, you know, what we say, when you say Allahu Akbar, we raise, the Imam raises his hand. And the followers have their hands folded on their breast, on the chest, right? So this is clearly depicted on the coin. Not only that, they have beards. They're shown to have beards, okay? And their clothes are above their ankles. I mean, which is something, which is a tricky opinion, right? Nowadays, people wear their clothes above their ankles, right? So the caliph has his clothes above his ankles, right? And he's raising his hand. And now, in the hadith literature, we are told in collections like Bukhari and Muslim that the Prophet prayed, and when he started his prayer, he raised his hands and split his fingers like that, okay? And raised his hands up to his shoulders, right? This is what the hadith literature tells us. And we see that depicted on the coin. So the caliph is raising his hands up to the shoulders and the fingers are split. They are actually shown split on the coin. So what does this show? This shows that our salah described in the hadith literature is exactly how it was practiced in the first century of Islam. Very close to the time of the Prophet while his companions were alive. 74 Hijri, many hundreds of companions were alive, including people like Anas bin Malik, who was alive. He died in 94, he died 20 years later. So coins are not to be belittled and ignored anymore, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. They can teach us a lot. They can teach us the amount of history we cannot imagine. They are neglected. They are highly neglected by our traditional scholarship. And this is a field we need to explore more carefully, and we will find many more wonders hidden in them. Thank you so much for listening to me. I don't want to go on talking about my personal interests and my fascinations. I hope you took some ideas from me, and inshallah, hopefully we will continue to work together to make this world a better place by promoting book culture and our heritage, its preservation. Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.